Funding for this talk comes from TrialX, connecting patients to clinical trials.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Cure Panel Talk Show on Nanotechnology. I'm Priya Menon, Scientific Media Editor at Cure Talk, and along with the Cure Talk team of Shahid Khan and Chintan Patel, I welcome all of you this afternoon to a discussion on nanotechnology. As always, we will be moderating the call and bringing people live on the show. Cure Panel Talk Show is organized by Cure Talk, the blog of TrialX.com, an online platform to connect patients to clinical trials of new treatments. For information on clinical trials for all conditions, please visit TrialX.com/ask. This is the 19th episode of the Cure Panel Talk Show and the second time we are discussing nanotechnology on this platform. We are excited to announce that today's show has been selected to be featured on Block Talk Radio. Today we have with us Dr. Matthew Putman, CEO and founder of Nanotronics Imaging, who is joining us from France. Dr. Putman is also a professor and researcher at Columbia University. Dr. Putman holds 5 patents and has published over 20 technical papers. He has also produced several plays and films and is an accomplished composer. He's a founding member of the World Science Festival, is on the executive board of the Montauk Observatory, and is an artist in residence for imaging, Imagine Science Films. Welcome to the show, Dr. Putman. We also have with us Andrew Retick, patient manager at Netamid. Mr. Retick works closely with doctors, researchers, and clients to ensure that the research being done precisely meets the client's needs. Welcome, Andrew. Next, we have Dr. George Sylvester with us. Dr. Sylvester is a maternal-fetal medicine specialist at Weill Cornell Medical College. A graduate of McGill University in Montreal, Dr. Sylvester received his MD from the McGill University Faculty of Medicine. Welcome to the show, Doctor. Kimberly Blasey will be co-hosting the show with me today. Kimberly is a senior clinical research professional and entrepreneur. She's currently working in business development at Nanotronics Imaging. On the panel, we have Ranjan Kumar, Sarthak Sinha, and Arjun Nair, and they join us from Canada. Ranjan Kumar is a PhD candidate in neuroscience at the University of Calgary, Canada. He's studying the role of adult dermal stem cells derived Schwann cells in peripheral and central nervous system repair. Sarthak is a student at Henry Wisewood High School in Calgary. Sarthak has been working the past 2 years doing graduate-level research in Jeff Bernasicki's Experimental Medicine and Stem Cell Biology Lab, University of Calgary. Arjun Nair is a grade 11 student at Webber Academy in Calgary. Last year, under the guidance of Dr. David Thomas Cramp at the University of Calgary, he conducted research on improving the efficiency of a promising cancer therapy utilizing gold nanoparticles and heat shock protein inhibitors. Before I hand over to Kim here, I would like to remind the audience that we will be taking in questions at the end of the discussion. If you have a question for our panel, you may press 1 on your keypad and we will bring you live on air to ask your questions. Kimberly would now introduce us to the topic of discussion. Kim, you're on air.
Great. Hi, everyone. Priya, am I coming through okay?
Yes, yes, Kimberly, you're absolutely
clear. Oh, good. Great. Hi. So thanks for inviting me on to co-host with you, and thanks everyone out there who's listening. It's an honor to be part of such an esteemed panel. So I want to keep this brief. My goal is basically twofold. One is to basically bring all of the panelists together today and just unite us in the context of what we're speaking about. And secondly, to give a bit of a background and introduction to nanotechnology and what prevention is. So first of all roads point back to Matthew. All of us panelists actually work with Matthew in one way, shape, or form, either with businesses or on projects together. But actually more broadly, all of the panelists are also interested in progressing healthcare and are fundamentally, I believe, interested in progress, period. And then to kind of begin to define nanotechnology, it's actually a generalized term used to describe very small and precise technology that functions on the nanometer or molecular scale. And although nanotechnology is small, it works to solve very big issues. So, for example, memory storage on your computer or cell phones are all forms of nanotechnology, Other examples are the use of nanotubes or nanoparticles to reinforce metals for construction or rubber for tires, for example. There's a whole range of examples I actually won't go into, but that can give you some sense for things. And then nanotechnology in healthcare is the ability to take advantage of and use complex chemicals and or devices to improve human health at the nanometer scale, either inside the body. So, for example, insulin is an example here of nanotechnology to treat a disease directly, or outside the body, such as creating better and faster means to diagnose diseases. So prevention is simply treating patients before diseases begin, so to try to stave off diseases or avoid diseases using nanotechnology. So in essence, our talk today is about nanotechnology to be used in such a way. So nanotechnology is used in such a way to prevent diseases from even occurring. So that's what our talk is about. And so just to finish up here, the more we know about both the human body and our ailments at smaller and smaller scales, the better and sooner will we be able to treat patients. Perhaps we can even begin to reform how our entire healthcare system works with better, more refined, and more personalized methods of treatment and preventative care. So I hope I've been able to kind of root us all together here on the panel and introduce the topic at hand today. So I would first like to again thank Cure Panel for allowing me to co-host, and I want to now invite Dr. Matthew Putman to speak on this topic.
Well, thank you, Kimberly. You know, it's amazing to hear that I'm the one who brings things together on a topic regarding healthcare. 5 years ago, I would certainly have said I have no expertise in the matter, and I would still say that my expertise is certainly limited in comparison to everybody on this panel. So I'm lucky to be joined by George and by Andrew. What this all came about, the reason I say 5 years ago, 5 years ago I was a material scientist, as I still am, who worked on imaging and on instrumentation. So I provided a tool, but I provided a tool for industrial products. And I've learned since that time not to be limited by my own imagination. And the one way that I learned this was through a discussion in Paris with George Sylvestre on this panel, when he asked me what my dreams and goals were for a new technology I was developing. The technology that I was developing was a way in which we can see things using light, that are smaller than anybody else could see over a wider area than anyone else could see. I was thinking about this in terms of fields that I was familiar with. Those were looking at nanoparticles in materials and looking at things like transistors, as you spoke about before. George quickly made me realize that my vision was limited. He didn't say that because he's such a nice guy, but what he did say was that there is an enormous need in his field for rapid quantitative analysis, and that quantitative analysis, if done at an early enough stage, can prevent major illnesses in gynecological illnesses, the areas in which he worked. And this this led me to, or already sparked my impatience to want to do something about this. And you'll hear from George about the problems with current systems of measuring for women's testing around the world, and issues in mortality rates around the world, but even some issues in the United States and Europe, inefficiencies, expenses, lack of knowledge. And so this opened the first line of questioning. If we could see something small enough, what can we do to prevent things from happening, to prevent cancers in particular from ever forming? This is what I will be discussing today, is a technology in which we hope and that we believe will enable this to happen, not only for the specific cancers, cervical cancer and uterine cancer that we'll be discussing with George and with Andrew, But this should be something that is scalable for many diseases, so that we're no longer talking about disease prevention. We're no longer talking about diseases, but we're talking about complete prevention. So this sets up a little bit. You're all, of course, welcome to ask questions, and I'm sure we'll get into the details of what we actually do if in terms of imaging and prevention as we get into this. But I certainly want to give these guys a chance to talk.
Great. That's great, Matthew. And I actually forgot you were talking all the way from France. So thanks very much for your late night speaking with us.
Can you hear me okay? Can you hear me okay?
Yes. Can you hear me okay?
Yes. Yeah, you sound great, Kimberly.
Okay, good, good. Yeah, you're coming through loud and clear. I just had remembered that you were in France, so I know it's quite late there. So just wanted to thank you for staying up late with us. Great, that was a wonderful introduction to what you'll be discussing. Now I'd like to go ahead and invite Andrew Reddick of MetaMed to share your views on nanotechnology and healthcare and prevention.
Well, thank you, Matthew. Every time I hear you talk about your technology, I realize it has this other facet or some other facet or some other application that just makes it much more interesting, and I'm so glad to MetaMed's gotten to be involved in that and for my role in that. What MetaMed's approach or outlook with regards to healthcare and prevention, or healthcare prevention and nanotech, is basically is looking at the exact breadth of nanotechnology today. Everything in medicine is becoming smaller, is becoming more customized, more tailored to the individual patient, more personalized, which is MetaMed's approach. And this means that diagnostic involves looking deeper into the patient's genetics and looking into what's going on. And Matthew's technology has significant applications there that he's just scratching the surface on right now. But also this ends up becoming is everything you put into your body more and more stops being chemistry and stops being compounds that are found in nature and starts being more and more these things that are being artificially developed. Which more and more fall into the header of nanotechnology. Since the topic of today is prevention, one of the most important things is about general health. Right now, the healthcare system is structured in such a way that it's only when you get sick that you start engaging with it. You start engaging, you start looking for treatments for diseases, diagnosing your cancer, treating your cancer, whatever. Or you start profiling, taking steps, you get a genetic test, you go through 23andMe, whatever, and you end up getting a genetic, and you end up finding that you're at risk for a particular condition. And so you take precautionary measures there, against Parkinson's or Alzheimer's, dietary restrictions. But ultimately what happens is we're all getting older. We're all going to get sick at one time or another. And there are general purpose preventative measures, just health optimization, health improvement things that can be done. One of the things that MetaMed has been exploring but hasn't gotten a chance to develop yet is a compound referred to as ACE-31, which was brought in for medical, which was rejected by the FDA a few years ago. This compound was nanotechnology. It's something you get receive two or three injections subcutaneous over the course of a few weeks. And it's an artificial protein blocker that functionally removes the proteins in your bloodstream that inhibit muscle growth. Now, using the this was restricted. This ended up failing for safety reasons, despite the fact that all of the people in the clinical trials said that the side effects were trivial, nosebleeds and headaches. But what this ends up, what something like this would end up doing would be develop would be allowing for increased muscle mass and reduced body weight, significant reduction in body weight over a short period of time, a few months, losing 8% of your body fat, percentage of the body fat, not percentage point, which technology like this, improving the allowing this nanotech to improve the health baseline of people, could potentially, with further study, be able to reduce obesity, incidence of obesity, and generally make people healthier and thus able to resist a host of other conditions. The fact of the matter is, this is just one thing that we've stumbled across in our research while looking for other treatments and other projects to pursue and things for clients. And we don't know how much is out there, how much can be developed at this current level of at our current level of manufacturing and material science, what that can do for medicine. And this is very much an underexplored area. Mm. Okay, I think that sort of gets where I am.
Great. Oh, that was a great example of the ACE-31 compound. Mm-hmm. Of what you're getting at, Andrew. So thanks for sharing. I'll introduce our third panelist, Dr. George Silvestri. George, just to remind people, is the OBGYN Vice President there at Jamaica Medical Center. And Dr. Silvestri, I'd like to invite you on to speak about your views on using nanotechnology as prevention.
Yes, so thank you, everybody, for inviting me. It's really an honor to speak with such a great panel. As you know, I'm a physician and not a bench scientist per se, but I try to get an understanding of this new technology, which I think is really promising. As most of you know, cervical cancer is really an important women's issue. In fact, if you look at it about a century ago and right now in developing countries, it is one of the leaders in terms of killers for women, and it's too bad. It's the number one killer in GYN cancer out there, and it's completely preventable and screened for early. Cervical cancer was one of the first cancer that we screened for. The Pap smear came about in the 20s and 30s, and the introduction of Pap smear decreased the incidence and the mortality of cervical cancer by 90% in the developed countries, which is really remarkable in terms of medical technology. But unfortunately, in the developing countries, it's still a major problem. And it's a problem because screening is easy for us, but it's not cheap as a technology, especially elsewhere. It takes experienced cytopathologists to analyze the cells. It takes slides. It takes microscopes. It takes some medium to read the slides. So it's limited by that. So that these hurdles make screening in some populations very difficult. So when I heard about nanotechnology and what it could do, I thought maybe eventually we could apply it to make a Pap smear, amongst other things. That's my field, so this is what I understand. The Pap smear cervical cancer screening, a bedside test, and not only a bedside test, but a test which could be interpreted at a distance. That is, if you take a sample of cervical cells from the patient, have the result at the bedside right then and there, and if you are in a remote community in Africa or in northern Canada, to have somebody who is not necessarily a physician but take the sample and have somebody via nanotechnology and technology in general read and interpret the screen immediately. So that would allow the test to be performed in a lot more women and be accessible in a lot of people. and also potentially in some communities even like ours to have a bedside test, because even right now when a pap smear is performed, a cervical cancer screen is performed, there's still a certain amount of weight necessary to have the result. You can eliminate that weight and streamline the care that would make everybody happy. So this is one of the applications I could think of pertaining to my field, and I'm sure there are many others that would benefit from this technology.
Great, Dr. Silvestri. Thanks for sharing that. And thanks again to all the panelists who shared on your views and also just for being here. So now I'm going to kick things off. I have a few questions to ask of the panel, and then I'm going to turn it over to our other guests to ask their questions. So my first question is for Matthew and also for you, Dr. Silvestri. And so basically, in order to progress and create the future, we have to see it. And I know, Matthew, you're a fan of that line. I know, Matthew, you're
passionate. I think I came up with that line, Kimberly.
I think you did. I know, Matthew, you're passionate about microscopy, and I'm pretty sure I know how to answer this, but for the benefit of our listeners, what is the first step you are hoping to take in regards to Nanotronics Imaging's NPATH in terms of nanotechnology and prevention? And also, George, you can feel free to pipe in here as well.
Right. It's George already laid out a little bit of what we're hoping
right.
to do. When George brought this up to me 3 years ago in Paris, I immediately started to speak with the public health professionals who talked about this horrible disease of cervical cancer and the amount of people dying in sub-Saharan Africa and other places, and I wanted to run there and start doing tests right away. And I also, I'm a cancer survivor myself, and I can tell you that George spoke to something that was very personal to me, and I know is true for many people who have had cancer or even considering getting tested for cancer, is that oftentimes the wait is as bad as the actual diagnostic and the actual result. So the first steps that we would like to take are to have a test which is that does the screening, the first line of screening right away. So this is a test which would normally be taken by a physician or a technician, and George can speak to who can do a PAP test. My understanding is that it is a test that many people can perform, and I'll let him speak to that. But in many parts of the world, it is performed by people other than medical doctors. But that this test could be performed very quickly, and we can do a screening, which is clearly defined by something called the Bethesda Guide, which says exactly what you should be looking for in squamous cells, which are the cells which become cancerous, to tell you if it's atypical. Now, what we do is not diagnostics, and what we aim to do is not diagnostics. What we aim to do is to point out things very early, cells that are starting to aggregate differently very early in accordance with this screening procedure that has already been laid out, which human technicians have had to do before, or batch tools that had to be sent out to other labs. We do this in a matter of seconds, so that then an on-site OBGYN or physician can diagnose, or in the cases of being in a rural area, like this could be uploaded to a cloud server, for instance, and be interpreted by a doctor remotely, so that there is no weight at all in the decision to whether the doctor should take a biopsy or not and move to the next stage. This saves both money and saves patients a lot of worry. George, maybe you could touch a little bit on this process.
Sure. I mean, the cancer of the cervix is a unique organ in that it is readily accessible compared to certain form of oral cancer or colon cancer. That's why it was a cancer which was screened early. in the history of medicine. And to take a swab of the cervix is really not that difficult. Midwives do it, birth attendants can do it abroad, a technician can do it, take that swab. But then when it comes time to read the cells on that swab, it's a different story. As Nancy was mentioning, some cancers can be screened for better than others because of the latency period. That is, the phase, the duration between the cells becoming abnormal and an invasive cancer to develop in cervical cancer can be years, which makes it great because then you have lots of time to screen for it. It's not like the disease happened and then it banged the typical cells and it formed and the cancer forms right away. That's not the case with cervical cancer. So there's a lag of time that you can that you give you time to screen. So taking the swab, anybody can be taught to do this, and then to have somebody remotely read it, pathologist or cytopathologist at a distance, and not only deciding if a biopsy needs to be done, that's important to know, but sometimes when you're in places where the patient is not near a hospital or a clinic, that'd be important. Let's say you're in a remote part of Africa and you're 6 hours drive from the nearest clinic. A decision to move a patient to have a colposcopy and have a biopsy of the cervix is a big one. It's costly,
right.
it's difficult. And I think it's a good time to talk about cervical cancer, and because although we have the vaccine against HPV and all of that, cervical cancer is a sexually transmitted disease. It is. Mm. And, we have increased incidence in some places because of, different practices toward sexuality. So it's a good time to catch it, to talk about it, and to prevent it. And if not to prevent HPV and its causes, at least to catch it at an early stage, not only in developed countries, but anywhere else.
Right. That's great. I mean, what you guys both spoke about was how using nanotechnology, which is the ability to see and determine diagnosis at such small scales at the cellular or even below that level using microscopy to determine diagnosis rapidly and quickly so that women, all kinds of women, whether they're here in America or eventually, hopefully, disadvantaged women all over the world could really benefit from this.
Yeah.
So that's a very, and I'm also working on this particular project, so I'm very personally passionate about it as well. So now I'm going to shift gears a little bit. Andrew, I actually wanted to ask you a question, and then I'll turn the panel over, rest of our questioners over to ask some questions. I'm very curious about MetaMed. I've been following it for a while now. And I know Matthew's involved. He's an advisor, so I've been getting exposed to it more and more. And I know you brought up the example of ACE-31. I'm wondering if you can give another example of kind of currently either what MetaMed is doing now or is interested in doing to use nanotechnology as some form of prevention.
Well, right now, MetaMed's approaches are personalized. So we have what we work on is very heavily dependent on what clients come forward and are interested in us. And our back-end research side of things is mostly in the AI space, not so much the nanotech space. In terms of straight prevention that we're working on, I'm not actually sure that we have anything else related. I mean, we've been working with Matthew on his microscope and applications thereof. We're currently working on a project with regards to precision lasering of cancer cells in a melanoma case.
Okay, cool.
MetaMed's primary approach is about the application of research and information, the precision application of information, in order to maximize the effectiveness of various treatments.
Okay, great. Well, I know
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Nothing, please.
Okay, no, I was going to say that's great. I know I have like three other questions that sparked in my mind to ask you, but I know our other questioners actually are going to probably ask you exactly the same thing I will. I'm going to leave it up to them. So the first question I'll invite is Ranjan Kumar. You are welcome to ask your questions to our panel. Ranjan, are you there?
Hello.
Hi, we can hear you.
Can you hear me there, please?
Yes, we can hear you fine.
Okay. Sorry, I thought you were unable to hear me. So my question is for Andrew here, which is based on, like as he mentioned, that his focus is on individual-specific medicine. So if someone starts a company like Andrew worked for the company in there, and like how you think that companies can make profit out of it as compared to generalized medicine? And a follow-up question on the same is, is this specific only for cervical cancer, or you have it open for any other diseases as well?
Can you repeat that question? I'm sorry.
By the way, this is Matthew. I cut out. I'm in this third world country of southwestern France. for some reason, I lost reception. I'm sorry. If this question is to me, please repeat it. If it's to somebody else.
Oh, no, Matthew, you're fine. It was luckily to Andrew, so no worries.
Okay, great.
We're all set here.
I apologize.
But welcome back. No problem.
I'll repeat my question again. So the question is, as you mentioned that your focus is on personalized medicine or individual-specific medicine therapy, I wonder how the companies which are focused on SNP-based therapies or these personalized medicine-based therapies, how do they make profit as compared to generic drugs, like which have a broad market open?
Generally, the companies that are doing personalized therapies or SNP therapies need to be able to address and reach out to their market. If you have a drug, if you have a treatment, if you have a new process that works extraordinarily well for someone with a particular gene,
mm-hmm.
That maybe a quarter or a tenth of the population has, then you need to be able to focus your outreach effort on that portion of the population like a laser, because ultimately you're going to find is the next generation is, as you probably know, the next generation of treatments are more effective, are these sorts of treatments that are breast cancer treatments that affect a particular type of breast cancer. So you can't just go out to find everybody with a tumor. Now, fortunately, we live in an era where gene sequencing prices are dropping nobody's business, faster than Moore's Law. So if you can screen out these things, so the future for businesses like that are looking brighter and brighter and brighter. We can identify, these people can be identified as long as the legal regimen is not adequate. And your second question was about whether this only applies to cervical cancer?
Right.
Oh,
limited to just cervical cancer? You mentioned, you already answered that you're looking for breast cancer as well. So it is applicable for like any cancer disease or like the disease of brain like Alzheimer's or Parkinson's or anything, like it can be applicable to any therapy, right? I got the answer for my second question.
It's definitely, these things are definitely broadly, these tailored approaches are applicable to most, if not all, conditions. Cervical cancer is where a lot of people are starting because we'll let one of the other panelists answer because they're primarily dealing with cervical cancer. But largely, it's a target of opportunity. It's a first step on something much broader.
Yeah, this is Matthew again. On this, we don't want to over, you know, George is here, of course, for his expertise on cervical cancer, where I don't think Andrew or I could either speak to expertise on any one type of cancer. The idea from a Nanotronic standpoint, and I think a little bit goes for MetaMed as well, is that everything, you know, you start with a case in which you think you can address a solution. And in my case, I was lucky enough to have George come to me with a need. I think that MetaMed has people come to them and institutions come to them with mm-hmm. a particular need. And then we evaluate whether it's something that is doable right now, whether it's something that's doable in 5 years when technology converges to that point, or whether it's something that we'll look at in the future. This I wouldn't say that we're doing this because it's low-hanging fruit per se. We're doing it because there's a great need. But there are certainly equally great needs in other places where super resolution and high resolution imaging in order to detect things and personalized medicine in order to target things both and target illnesses and cancers apply.
Correct. Thank you, Matthew.
Great, Ranjan. Well, thank you for asking your question. And just to remind our listeners, Ranjan Kumar is PhD candidate in neuroscience at the University of Calgary in Canada. I would now like to invite our second questioner, Sartak Sina, onto the call. And to remind our listeners, Sartak is a student at Henry Weiss Wood High School, also in Calgary, Alberta. Sartak, go ahead.
Hi, Priya. And are you guys able to hear okay?
Yes, mm-hmm. We can hear you.
Yes, great.
Perfect. That was actually an interesting point which Ranjan brought up because I myself am pretty interested in the biotech industry. I recently saw a presentation. I thought it was quite fascinating. And sort of connected to that question, I was wondering specifically to Dr. Putman, the NSPEC and the NPATH, the two of your imaging microscopes, where do you think or which fields do you think it could be most heavily utilized for going in the field and how that implies to nanotechnology?
Right. I started out by saying that 5 years ago I would have had no idea that I would be on a health program at all. And I would like to keep that same type of open-minded attitude towards where we will be in the future. My expertise, I'm a material scientist, and I focused on imaging of nanoparticles. So that's what got me into the field. So I was interested in, you know, looking at reinforcers and electrical properties of nanoparticles. This didn't apply to medicine at all in my mind. But what you realize when you're doing both AI and so when you're doing artificial intelligence and when you're doing high resolution imaging, it can be contextualized in different ways. Now, we at Nanotronics, our focus right now, we have a focus in industrial applications as well as in healthcare applications. In healthcare applications, we're starting with these women's health issues because it's been underfunded in a large part, for one thing, in the past, and we're using very old technologies, and we would like to change that. And we're also, I'm focusing on this idea of cancer patients getting results quickly. So right now we're looking at squamous cell cancers, and we will continue, I think, to look at other types of squamous cell cancers. So perhaps looking at esophagus, oral cancers, would be, I think, a nice next step for us.
Wow. Thank you so much.
Great. Thank you, Sartak. Our third questioner, I'd like to... did someone say something? Okay, I'd like to invite on Arjun Nair, who is currently a grade 11 student at Weber Academy in Calgary, Alberta. And just to remind our listeners that He was involved with research on improving the efficiency of promising cancer therapy using gold nanoparticles and heat shock protein inhibitors. Arjun, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Sure.
Hi, so it's been really interesting and really cool listening to the panel and seeing all the ideas and cool discussions that's being spoken about. And so I was just wondering that from what I've been hearing is that a lot of the innovation that's coming out is the result of combining technologies from different fields. So does the panel believe that, you know, innovation coming out of the 21st century is primarily going to be the result of an interdisciplinary approach?
Well, this is Matthew. I mean, I absolutely think that that's the case. You know, I'm an applied physicist who's a material scientist who's now working on, you know, imaging squamous cells. This is not the future. This is the present. I teach at Columbia a class that is made that has chemical engineers, physicists, biologists, and we all have to start speaking the same language. And, of course, the next step is having medical doctors speaking the same language as we do as well. And I think this is absolutely crucial. And I do think that even though often these walls are high at universities, I think that the necessity mm-hmm. and the exciting possibilities in industry are helping to really reshape this discussion. And we're no longer just talking about translational medicine. We're talking about translational technology.
Mm-hmm. So do you see any changes happening in universities right now that are looking to foster this interdisciplinary approach?
George is also in the university. Do you want to speak to this, George? Or
no, I completely agree. I think as somebody was discussing earlier, this size is no longer a limit or less than used to be. Cancer used to be diagnosed with a big mass, and now we look at, you know, cells and then smaller than cells and then nanotechnology and all that. And I think if you look at other aspects, there's a public health aspect. When you're a public health specialist, your patient is a population. So you don't look at a bunch of cells, but a bunch of patients, and a bunch of patients in a particular place in a particular setting. Mm. So that really helps also to design the best approach.
Thank you.
Yeah, universities, I will put this out here as a challenge to universities. They are making the effort. There's a building. A building at Columbia, a new building, which is an interdisciplinary building. And Columbia is one of the older universities to try to do something like this. So it is something that is being acknowledged. Certainly places like MIT and Stanford have already addressed it. But, you know, I tend to be excited by the things that are happening in outside of university environment as well. I think that you will start to see you will start to see a physics and a complexity theory and AI approach to many things. And that can come from kids who have created video games to young mathematicians. And so it's coming from a lot of different areas right now, and I think that needs to be embraced rather than just looked at from a more traditional university academic standpoint.
Cool. Thank you.
Andrew, I'd like to give you a chance as well to answer, as Arjun's question was for the panel, in terms of interdisciplinary collaboration. What are your thoughts on that in terms of just your experience with MediMed?
Well, I'm going to be the third person on the panel to agree with the basic principle that that the future of technological improvement of these sorts of things comes from interdisciplinary advances. What I end up seeing when I look at things that are being developed and technologies that are being developed, primarily in the private sector, is things continue to become more advanced at they're along whatever function they're developing at. At the same rate at the same function they've been doing for a long time. But as things become more advanced, they become more complex. There's more widgets, there's more applications. there's more capacity for things to do. And as capacity gets added to various different technologies, different applications, different fields, the opportunities and the ability for things to combine in new and different ways is apparent. I know Matthew likes to be humble and say that his technology is, you know, something anybody could have done. He was just there at the right time, or I've heard him say that. And I don't agree. I think it takes a level of vision and awareness of what is possible out there, looking at several different fields in order to combine them in a way that he has. And I think that there's a lot of opportunity for people who take approaches like that in order to found new companies, not even with cutting-edge technology, but with stuff that's been around for even 5-10 years, to just combine them and put them together into a new and extraordinarily useful way that can change the world.
Yeah, I'll have to agree with you there, Andrew, about Matthew. I work with Matthew.
Oh, God.
Incredibly smart.
But as you know, Kimberly, there's a lot of people at Nanotronics doing a lot more of the of this creation than I am. So we have to give credit to all of you guys.
Hence back to the interdisciplinary collaboration. But, well, great. Well, I think we have time for maybe a few more questions from our questioners here, and then maybe Priya can help us open it up to the larger audience. So let me circle back to Ranjan. I know you had at least one more question for our panel that you haven't asked yet. Ranjan Kumar, are you there with us? Are you there, Ranjan?
Oh, hi. Hi, Kimberly. Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can hear you. Welcome back. I just wanted to see if you had another question for our panel.
Yes, I have one more question, and I think Matthew can answer this or anyone else if would like to. My question is about a new branch of science which is recently started, is optogenetics. And what they do there is just they specifically using light, like microscopy light, they stimulate a certain area in the brain and then look for the response. Matthew, do you think that you guys are in the future looking for certain kind of approach at Nanotronics, a similar kind of approach to deliver drugs or to deliver like nano formulations in different, like either it is cancer or it is a myeloma or like using your microscopy technique?
Yeah, absolutely. This is a incredibly interesting topic to me. One thing that we, you know, where I like to be completely open-minded and to think about, we could go in many different directions. The one thing that Nanotronics does focus on is the imaging side of it and image analysis side.
Right.
We don't deal with therapeutics at all. This is why we like to partner with groups like MetaMed and people like George and Jamaica Hospital and those that do. Our expertise is really on the analysis side. I consider ourselves more of a software company than a microscopy company. But this is something that we can help enable, and you know, and this is where we certainly seek partnerships rather than have expertise ourselves.
Excellent. Thank you, Matthew.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ranjan. Priya, I'm not sure what you think. Shall we open up the call to our general listeners?
Hi, Kim. I think we can just announce to the listeners, too, and then we can carry on. Listeners, if you have a question for our panel, can please press 1 on your keypad, and we can bring you live on air to ask your question. Listeners who have a question for our panel can please press 1 on your keypad, and we can bring you live on air to ask your question. When we wait for our questions, we might as well proceed with the discussion. I think, Arjun, I think you have an interesting question to ask. Arjun, you're there?
Yep.
Yeah, please ask your question, Arjun.
Hello?
Arjun?
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Please ask. Yes, we can.
Go ahead, Arjun. We can hear you.
Yeah. So I just have a question for Dr. Radick. And I was recently listening to a TED Talk, and they were talking about the tendency for pharmaceutical companies to produce biased research results. And so I know that a key component of MetaMed is utilizing all the resources available through literature. So does MetaMed account for the large amount of alleged tendency for drug companies to produce these biased research results?
First off, I want to say I'm not a doctor. I actually need to be fairly emphatic about this in my line of work. And secondly, yes, we do. We, as part of our research process, in terms of as part of our research, as part of our fundamental aspect of our research process, when we first look, when our researchers first look at a paper, when they first look at a study, they evaluate all the, they're attempting to figure out exactly how valuable the information in that study is. This incorporates information like the experimental protocols, the sample sizes, the effect sizes, and things like who's funding it. I think I actually know the TED Talk you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And as, it talks about how the effects, when you plot the distribution of the effects of an experiment on based on the sample sizes, it ends up converging into a sort of triangle shape. And when you look at the when you look at the ones where the pharma companies do, it's, you know, half of the triangle, because they cut out all of the studies that don't support their drug. And what this means is that the smaller the sample size, the less reliable a drug company trial is. But larger sample size, the way the drug companies mess with clinical trials, larger sample sizes are harder to do. And we take all of this into account when we're putting together our research reports.
Wow, that's very thorough. That's really cool.
Thank you, Arjun. Sajak, a few minutes for a quick question.
For sure. I actually had a question waiting for Dr. Andrew, if you don't mind. And my question was, what sort of sparked your journey in the field of personalized medicine? It's something, you know, which seems like sort of the next big revolution in medicine. And how feasible do you think it is? And what sort of led you in this field?
What got me involved is I was personally involved with the Singularity Institute for many years. And when several people from that particular nonprofit got together and saw over the course of hosting the events, the Singularity Summit, that these top-level brilliant scientists were unable to get their work, able to get cutting-edge work properly funded and supported by the academic funding establishment. So they end up doing things like getting crowdfunding, funding experiments out of salary, or just going out and fund and creating a startup to develop applications. They end up, these scientists are being underutilized out in the world. So what's the best thing we can do to just, so what we want to do is we want to go out and we want to hire them. This is sort of the purpose. This is the purpose of the MetaMed Advisory Board. What we're doing now is we noticed that there is just a complete lack of medical care, of connection between medical treatment and the medical and the research in the medical system. There's large amounts of really, really good work being done by medical researchers, and it's not making it to actual treatment, to actual patients. And when it overwhelmingly. And when it does, it's taking decades to get there. So we're trying to cut short that process, get that information to the patients, get that information to the doctors in a purer form. I mean, there was just a big gaping hole in a big gaping unmet need in the world. And so we get to go around helping sick people and funding original science. It seems like a great thing to do. Did that answer your question?
Thank you, Sartik. We have a question from one of our listeners for the panel. Are nanoparticles the next generation asbestos? Matthew, maybe you could answer this.
I'm sorry, could you please repeat the question?
Are nanoparticles the next generation asbestos?
I didn't understand the last word. I'm sorry. Could somebody...
Asbestos.
Yeah, are nanoparticles the next generation asbestos?
Yeah.
Oh, next generation asbestos. Okay, I'm sorry. No, well, you know, nobody knows that answer, but I would certainly say that the comparison is not a great one. There are questions about toxicity when you're talking about things that are extremely small, but the rewards for nanotechnologies, nanoparticles, I think far outweigh the risks at this point. And I do think that precautions, certainly in medical nanoparticles in medicine, have been taken maybe even to an extreme. Especially if you're dealing with people with diseases, you want to find a cure and a targeted cure. There's nothing more targeted right now that we know of that can act in a natural, fast, physical way than certain nanoparticles. So is there a potential for toxicity amongst certain nanoparticles? Absolutely, and we should be vigilant about it. However, I don't think that's the most exciting thing to going on, or the biggest thing to talk about when talking about nanotechnology. I think that the hope is far greater than the risk. But that,
oh, thank you.
We need to keep our eyes on it for sure.
Yeah. Dr. Sylvester, what are the implications of nanoparticles in pregnant women, fetuses, and newborn babies?
On what, sir? On newborn babies?
Yeah.
Yes.
Honestly, I wouldn't be able to answer that question as a non-scientist, but I'll defer.
Dr. Sylvester?
I apologize.
Yeah.
I cannot answer that question. This is, to my knowledge, there's no application to it right now, but again, I'm a non-scientist for this new technology.
I don't mean to rephrase as I'm not certainly your the listeners' questions are very valid. What do I know? But when I talk to you, George, it's not just nanoparticles, but we're talking about the nanoscale. I think of a virus, for instance, as being a nanoparticle in a sense. And mm-hmm. a bacteria as being a nanoparticle. I'm interested if we know the effect of, and I think a lot of questions are coming out, the effect of, if a mother, for instance, has HPV, and should they be treated, and what effect that may have on a baby. I mean, there are a number of things like this that then... us who are trying to image and to try to create therapies, both those that are imaging and create therapies, have to take into account. That's the first step before we even design a nanoparticle. Is there anything new or interesting that you could touch on there, George?
The diagnostic modalities become more and more sophisticated, way beyond MRI. So perhaps in terms of diagnosing more subtle things such as molecular level in the brains, there's so many
brain problems and so many syndromes that we don't understand the origin. All we suspect is the origin genetic, but what they do, what kind of protein in the brain, where exactly in the brain it's located. So I mean, just there's so much to be learned in medicine that we still don't know. So because smaller is always probably more precise, I imagine it will have an impact at some point.
Right. Just a last question for the panel. When we're talking about protection, nanotechnology as prevention, are we thinking of some nano vaccines that are being developed? Matthew?
Are we thinking of, I'm sorry, are we thinking of what?
Nano vaccines.
Are some nano vaccines being
developed?
You know, this is certainly out of my expertise. I don't. Andrew, do you have any
maybe Dr. Sinvis
thoughts?
I have nothing I can really comment on. I have some ideas of what I would look up to read for half an hour before I could say something. Nothing more than that.
Okay, I think we are almost at the end of our time. Thank you. It was a wonderful discussion. Dr. Pittman, Sylvester, and Andrew, and Kim, it was great having you here. Ranjan, Sarthak, and Arjun, thank you for joining us. QTalk thanks all its listeners and participants. Thank you all for your support. And we look forward to having all of you join us for the next Cure Panel Talk Show on Health Tech, discussing wearable EEGs in clinical trials with advanced brain monitoring on August 6th at 5 p.m. ET. Our next show in July is on myeloma, featuring Dr. Shaji Kumar of Mayo Clinic, Rochester. We have an interesting lineup of shows for you. Please visit trialx.com/curetalk for more information on upcoming shows. The link to today's broadcast will be sent to all participants. We would love to hear from you. Please send us your feedback to priya@charix.com. Thank you. Thank you, Kim. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Hi, everyone.
Bye-bye.